Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 47 of NML Crossing, where we have finally arrived at No Man's Land. Can you believe it? I mean, it's been 2.5 months, 47 episodes, 46 episodes, I guess, not counting this one. But we are finally in the new normal. It's funny, I was out and about with the wife today, and on the way home, I was talking about recording this episode, and I was like, oh, today's the first time I'm talking about No Man's Land. And she looked at me funny, and she's like, haven't you been doing that since you started? Haven't you been doing that for months now? And I was like, no. Well, yes and no, I guess. But no, we had to get to No Man's Land first. And I explained to her, I mean, she was glazing over at this point, but I'm like, no, first we had to do Cataclysm, then we had to do Aftershock. And she's like, okay, stop. You know, fine, great. You're at No Man's Land now. Congratulations. And it reminded me how funny it is to talk to the, you know, uninitiated about this kind of thing, because this program's mission statement is talking about No Man's Land. So it would stand to reason anybody would figure, oh, this idiot's talking about No Man's Land. But to those of us who know, well, we know we got to get there first, and we got to set the table. We need the context, the good, the bad, the indifferent sort of context. But I think we've done an okay job putting, you know, laying everything down here. We didn't do Contagion. We didn't do Legacy. You know, I didn't want to get to the slippery slope where it's like, where do you even, you know, you keep working backwards, right? You keep working backwards. How far backwards do you go? And I think I mentioned this in the very first episode of this show, that I struggled with exactly where to start. And at one point, I mean, we were going to start with, like, Vengeance of Bane. It's like, no, that's way, way too far. Way too far back. So, Cataclysm it was, and, well, we're finally through it all. And it's time to say goodbye to Gotham and hello to No Man's Land. So, how about I stop vamping, and we get right into that, because we got a very, very long script today. We've got like a cosmic treadmill length script today, so it's a lot to talk about. I'm going to try to keep the analysis portion very, very light for this, since at this point, you know, without spoiling anything, all we really have are questions at the end of this issue. We're kind of, we're in the, you know, if we're building a mansion, this issue is laying that first row of bricks. So all we have is setup, and to, you know, with the power of hindsight, we know what's going to happen. So in order to sidestep ruining this for anybody, including myself, I'm just going to keep it light today. It's going to be a lot of facts. We might ask some questions, but we're not going to go too deep in answering them just yet, because the questions will be answered. But I want us to kind of get there organically. So the analysis portion of this episode is going to be light, which is probably a relief, because the analysis portions of anything I do is usually a very circular Ouroboros sort of a thing here, where I'm just chasing my own tail. Anyway, let's get into it. Today, we are talking about Batman No Man's Land number 1. Which had a March 1999 cover date. The story is called No Law and a New Order, Part 1, Values. Written by Bob Gale, with pencils by Alex Maleev. Inks, Wayne Foucher. Colors, Digital Chameleon. Letters, Willie Schubert. Edits, Gorfinkel, Peterson, O'Neill, and a newcomer, Joseph Illich. And this had a cover price of $3.95, and this is for the lenticular cover here. This is the Alex Ross thing. You know, you turn it, and it, there was the Superman Forever that came out around the same time, maybe a year earlier. Well, you know, you tilt it and it does the little thing like lenticulars do. There was also a standard format here, and I don't know the price of that offhand. I would assume it was probably maybe $2.99, maybe $1.99. Couldn't say. I probably should have looked that up. But anyway, let's get into the story. We open this brand new era with the Shadow of the Bat. Well, a couple of bats. They're looming over some yellow spray paint in the shape of a bat. Now, this is just our title page. From here, though, we do get a bit of an overview of this new Gotham. Now, the entire city has been fenced off, anybody who enters from this point on will be considered trespassers. Signs have been posted warning that should you enter Gotham, you would also be leaving the United States of America. We see a giant Welcome to Gotham City sign, which has been graffitified to read Hell Comes to Gotham City. We see the army is set up outside the city limits. There's tons of barbed wire, watchtowers, guns aplenty. I mean, they are armed to the teeth. Now, some of the boots on the ground, they're chatting up current events, theorizing that this whole ordeal is just a scam by the insurance companies using their sway over the government in order to avoid paying out any claims post-quake. Which sounds pretty sinister, if not 100% believable. I mean, you could almost see the scumbags in power in our world attempting something like this if it suited their interests or fed their bottom lines. Just then, we see a priest pulling up to the gates with some humanitarian aid. He's got canned food, meds, batteries, all stuff that people stuck inside Gotham would find useful. And he's sent away. Nothing goes into Gotham and nothing comes out. Now this priest, he tries pleading with the soldier to let him get these materials to the needy folks who remained in no man's land. And the soldier, to his credit, says, you know, he agrees with the father. But so long as he's wearing his uniform, his opinions don't matter. He's got orders to follow and he intends to follow them. And so the priest drives away. Elsewhere, we see a helicopter offering tours over No Man's Land for $50 a pop. We got a fellow who boards the chopper, and he offers to pay a little bit more if he can get a closer look, which would place them in restricted airspace here. You can't get that close without being potentially shot down. And this fella and the pilot, they go back and forth, and they finally settle on $300 for this experience. You see, the passenger, he brought a big thing of food with him that he's wanting to drop into the city. And you might be thinking, what a nice guy. You know, he wants to help the people. But no. No. This dude wants to drop the goods just so he can watch the No Man's Landers fight over them. Hopefully kill each other over them. Now, just as the chopper is being chased out of airspace by the military, our dude drops the box. Which takes us down to ground level, where some adolescent-ish types happen across the goods. One of them finds a sandwich, another finds a little box of cookies, and a third one nabs an apple. Let's stick with the sandwich guy for a bit. Just as he goes to take a bite down on it, some jerk on a bike swipes it right out of his hands and rides away. Sandwich guy slingshots a tennis ball betwixt the thief's shoulder blades. The thief then finds himself walking right into Harvey Bullock. Harv points out that the kids on GCPD turf, pointing to their blue graffiti tag on a nearby wall. The kid thinks that this is the Hook Street Gang's turf, but Bullock corrects him. You see, the cops done took it over about a week ago. And there's going to be, like I think I mentioned this last episode, maybe the one before that, there's going to be a whole lot of turf war stuff going on. That's going to be kind of the basis for much of the conflict we're going to get, at least in the early parts of No Man's Land, even throughout the entire line here, the entire crossover event. Now, Harv, he then tells the kid that Ramon, the guy who found the sandwich, he's under GCPD protection, or Blue Boys protection, as they're going by now. Hardbach then appears, and the two techs discuss possible punishment for this thief. They're thinking about implementing some old-fashioned justice. You know, chopping off the kid's hands. The thief quickly apologizes and promises not to be a bother anymore. Bullock warns him to stay the hell at a tri-corner. We next jump over to Cookie Girl, who finds her bounty swiped as well. She follows her thief into a building graffiti tagged with an S for Lord S. As in Lord Scarface. A.K.A. the friggin' Quake Master. Worth noting, the puppet's left eye has been blown out, a callback to Hardbach blowing its wooden brains out at the end of Cataclysm, even though he had a whole head in the shadow of the Bat Three-parter we recently discussed. Maybe another sign that attention to detail was kinda slippery during the Road 2 era. Anyway, the thief runs inside, and we learn that Scarface really wants them damn cookies. The ventriloquist tries to talk him out of it, stating that stealing is wrong. After some arguing, Scarface shoots the cookie thief, assumedly killing him. Lord S then demands a cookie and is nearly fed one with the kid's blood on it. We see that Scarface is a gang leader whose followers question their own sanity for throwing in with a stupid puppet. A stupid one-eyed puppet, even. Next, let's go over to Apple Boy. Now, just as he's about to sink his teeth into it, he's approached by some other guy who wants to offer him a trade for it. He offers him some soap for the apple. But kid would rather be dirty than hungry. Our trader then ups the ante to include 3 cans of beans and 2 cans of soup, which Apple Boy accepts. And so we follow the trader to a fence where he attempts to trade up on his newly gotten apple. He's offered a cell phone, a Walkman, a Rolex watch, and finally, a flashlight with fresh batteries. He takes the flashlight with the batteries, because nobody's got any need for any of that other stuff in no man's land. The fence then makes a call to trade up the apple himself. A call to the penguin, who, next we know, is auctioning off the same piece of fruit. And I gotta say, I'm loving this. Honestly, I don't even want to put this into the atmosphere here, but I almost wish there was some sort of, like, no man's world where we can see, like, the entire DC universe having to live like this. I mean, it would be completely upside down. And with the multiverse, I mean, it could happen and not really hurt any of the other toys. I probably shouldn't have put that out in the universe. Summer 2024, it'll be no man's world. Anyway, Penguin takes a bunch of bids before settling on a 20-carat diamond. A 20-carat diamond for an apple. It's hinted here that old Cobblepot has a secret pipeline to the outside that he can conduct business through. He then hands over the apple to that top bidder, though not before taking a big old bite of it himself. You see, Penguin always gets his cut. From here, we jump to a double-page spread of the still-smoldering Gotham City skyline, and we find out that this is day 93 of No Man's Land. So it's been 3 entire months since it was cut off from the rest of the United States. From here, we hop over to the clock tower, where Babs is journaling and laying down some exposition for us. Now, of course, we know her building is a Wayne building, so it was quake-proofed. Now, she's also been socking away supplies ever since the apocalypse virus pandemic at Contagion. So she's got a whole lot of canned food, bottled water, batteries, and the batteries are rechargeable and solar to boot. Now, she wonders to herself why she's stuck around, and for a moment, she thinks it might be due to her own ego. You see, she's still an information and data expert, and sees this as perhaps her time to shine. You see, she knows many of the nooks and crannies of old Gotham. She knows where the underground supply stashes are. I mean, she knows a lot. Just then, she's visited by a pair of young No Man's Landers who she's about to send out on a gathering mission. She gives them the location of a food stash, but warns that it's been poisoned. So, you know, don't go eating it. She has the poison neutralizing agent that only she can apply in order to make it edible. Thing of it is, it's just MSG powder. The food ain't tainted. She just wants to keep the kids honest and ensure that she gets her supplies. Now, she's referring to herself as a chronicler of No Man's Land. She's even been keeping a pen and paper account of everything that's gone on up to this point. So how about we read on and find out what's gone down? Feudalism is now a thing. Neighborhoods have been broken up and claimed by tribes and gangs. Each one is marked with a graffiti tag of whoever's running the place. And of course, we know Jeremiah Arkham let all the baddies out of Arkham before jamming out of the city himself. Well, at least this clarifies that he's gone. He didn't starve to death behind the shutters of Arkham. We next see a double-page spread map of the No Man's Land era Gotham City. It looks nothing like the one that we saw in the Wizard special a few months ago. Now, it's been color-coded by Barbara in order to show which gang runs each area. Tri-Corner, of course, is the home of the Blue Boys, a.k.a. the old GCPD. Old Gotham, where Oracle lives, is under a bit of a turf war. We got the Low Boys and the Street Demons, both of which end with a Z. At least on the map, she does spell Low Boys with an S a little bit later on. Two-Face has taken the downtown area and is operating out of the courthouse, kind of like he did in the Arkham City video game. Killer Croc, who I swear we saw escape to the seas not too long ago, is, in fact, still in no man's land. Now, he's considered something of a wild card. He's a nomad just looking for fights. Black Mask's crew, the False Facers, have taken over the Fashion District. Lord S controls Newtown. Poison Ivy has, naturally, taken over Robinson Park. The Huntress is controlling her neighborhood on Gotham's east side. The Joker is somewhere. Somewhere, nowhere, and everywhere, apparently. Penguin, Babs notes, is thriving in this new normal. See, he's not insane, first of all. And, entrepreneur that he is, he's established his very own Casablanca in his sector. Barbara also alludes to the possibility, or I guess likelihood, that Cobblepot's got an underground way of moving goods into and out of Gotham City, or no man's land. Barbara asks herself why anybody would stay after the EBAC order, and she theorizes that some folks had no choice in the matter. The poor, the destitute, illegal immigrants, and criminals. Also, she posits that some morons saw this as an opportunity for a grand adventure, and some were insane. She then goes into some of the new order for this no man's land. Value of objects here has become relative, just like during our earlier Apple trade up here. You know, Rolex watches ain't worth a damn. Instead, things like shopping carts and backpacks are among the most valuable. Crudely whittled spears are worth more than ammo-less guns. Protection's at a premium. Families have turned into clans, accepting new members based solely on what good they can do for the collective. Back to Babs herself, where she's looking at an issue of the Gotham Gazette online. The headline reads, "Wayne fails to convince feds to aid Gotham." And it's here we learn that Bruce hasn't been seen ever since. Bruce nor Batman, of course. She checks in with Tim and Dick to see if they'd heard anything. And, well, they have. Once. You see, they were both told to get out and stay out. And that was 3 months ago. Worth noting, we do see Robin and Nightwing doing what they were doing in their solo books for their brief appearances here. We see Nightwing is working alongside Superman, which did happen in Nightwing number 30, April 1999 cover date. Oddly, Superman also appears in that month's issue of Robin. Oracle recalls that, it's been 3 months since she heard from Bruce as well. From here, we shift over to Tri-Corner, where some gang members are trying to rob a family of their food stash. They're also trying to take the family's young daughters. From above, a seemingly caped figure drops onto the scene and, well, it's Hardbach in his trench coat. After KOing the baddies, he's joined by GCPD Captain Pettit, Harvey Bullock, Renee Montoya, and, making his first appearance, Clarence Foley. They order the gangbangers to strip off all their clothes and get the F out of Blue Boy's territory. Harvey begins to unspool some barbed wire to mark off this new building that they're claiming, while he and Bach discuss how nutty this all is. He compares themselves to the criminals, suggesting that the only difference between them now is their worthless badges. Cops and crims both view themselves as being above the law. But what happens when and where there is no law? They also talk about what it means to trespass in a no man's land. Nobody technically owns anything, so can trespassing even be a thing? Downstairs in the building, Montoya and Foley are sprinkling rat poison. They compare themselves to the very vermin they're attempting to eradicate. Foley admits here that he did not want to stay in Gotham after the deadline, but, well, he's a dedicated cop. He couldn't pull himself away from his police work, and he assumed this was never going to come to pass, or at the very least, they'd extend the deadline. They, of course, did not. Back topside, Bullock and Bach have a similar exchange. Bach says that he sometimes regrets staying, but would make the same decision again should the commish ask him to. Now this takes us over to Jim Gordon himself. He's being shown how to use a boomerang, since, you know, we are sort of back in the Stone Age here. He's then called up to the roof of their command center, and this is a magnificent scene. He's shown a makeshift bat signal. It's some tattered rags in the shape of a bat laid on a spotlight. Gordon proceeds to stomp the hell out of the thing. He shouts down to his crew saying he is not coming. It's been months now, and they are on their own. Montoya steps in to try to calm him down, suggesting that perhaps Batman is just waiting for the call. And Gordon's like, F that. He ain't buying it. Because if he were here, he'd have already joined the fight. Batman should know he's needed. And if he doesn't show up, then he just doesn't care. He says that Batman always took the easy way, citing that vigilantes don't need to have a code nor follow any rules. Montoya asks what the harm would be in having the signal in the skies. Hell, it might keep people in line. And Gordon says, no, we're not giving anybody false hopes. No more myths, no more urban legends, no more relying on Batman to instill fear. It's now left for the GCPD themselves to do that. Nearby on the roof, the poor idiot who set up the bat signal asks Sarah Essen what's up the commissioner's butt. She goes on to say that he goes to say the word Batman, but she stops him. Gordon doesn't even want to hear that word. If you absolutely need to refer to that guy, just call him the B. Essen reveals that Gordon was unable to get any police jobs outside of Gotham, all due to his rumored relationship with and reliance on a boogeyman. Now, he was apparently laughed out of many precincts in the weeks leading up to NML Day. Dude asks if Sarah thinks the Bee will ever show up, and she says she sure hopes not, and if he does, she doesn't want to be the person to have to tell the commissioner that he's back. We wrap up in an alley, where a couple of wanderers are trying to scrounge supplies, and they happen across a yellow graffiti tag of a bat. They wonder if this is a trick before looking skyward and seeing a pointy-eared figure in a cape atop a nearby building. They rush off, and we close out with our caped and cowled figure spray-painting another bat tag. That's where we leave it. Next time out, we meet the new Batgirl in Shadow of the Bat number 83. Now, we don't get a letters page here, obviously. It's a one-shot. But we do get a little look into the future. We have two pages here. One shows what's coming up in No Man's Land. The other one is showing us what's going on elsewhere in the Batman universe. Let's look at the upcoming here. January 1999, No Law and a New Order continues. And this, of course, is all going to be by Bob Gale and Alex Maleev. February of 1999, we get Fear of Faith, featuring The Scarecrow by Devin Grayson and Dale Eaglesham. And then in March 1999, we get two stories. We get Bread and Circuses, featuring The Penguin by Ian Edginton and Disraeli. And we get Mosaic, featuring Black Mask by Greg Rucka and Frank Terran. For the Elsewhere in the Bat Universe section, we got Robin number 62, where Tim settles into his new home of Keystone City, and he teams up with The Flash. Nightwing number 30, Superman appears to help out with some blued Havani stuff. Catwoman number 66, Selina's got nothing left to steal in Gotham, so she heads to Europe. And finally, Azrael number 51, where JPV gets struck by lightning, I think, which we're going to be covering in episodes 51 and 52 of this program. So, what do we all think? Huh. Yeah, I told you I was going to keep the analysis portion a little light this time out. I regret not being part of this when it happened. Because this must have been, no pun intended, this must have been earth-shattering for people following Batman. I don't know how they pulled this off. The gutsiness of this huge status quo change, it was, I can't believe they were brave enough to do something like this. The comics industry, then, now, and forever, not terribly brave, not really daring. They don't make waves so much. But this is just, it's insanely different. Like I mentioned the past few episodes here, it's like The Wizard of Oz, you know? It's black and white and then it's in color. This is a totally, totally different thing. This is a totally different animal than what we were getting before. The bright colors are gone. You know, there is no more supervillain silliness. This is feudalism. This is just gritty. This is It's really, really good. I like I said, like I always say, I do the Usenet thing still. I do the Usenet archives. And one of the biggest takeaways that I'm seeing, and it's you start to notice patterns the more you read people's thoughts on whatever. And one thing that everybody keeps saying is that the story makes no sense, but it's good. We talk about the internal logic of how can the story like this exist in a shared universe. We got to move past that, of course. Just accept that it is, because the stories we're going to get here are really, really good. I mean, the emotion that we're getting here, the fear, the we got a whole city here and it feels so claustrophobic. Just hopelessness abounds everywhere. To the point where if I were in the bat office right now and we had just released this book, I would be petrified because we wouldn't be able to walk it back. This is such a huge line in the sand here, going from the way things were to the way things are. And you have to wonder, like, how do you get back from this? How do you work your way back? And over the course of the next 100 or so episodes, I guess we're gonna figure that out together. But this was something else. The just oh man, I don't want to go too deep, but this set so many tables so well. From the look at how goods and services are looked at in Gotham post-closure here. Seeing that someone was willing to trade a 20-carat diamond for an apple, not even an entire apple, but just for fresh fruit. It really, just that simple thing right there shows that everything's different. When we look at Gotham back in the day, it's like, oh, well, that's Bruce Wayne's city. He's the rich guy, he owns half of it, and money is the power in most cities, in most civilized cities, right? It's no longer a civilized city. It is a hellhole. And we're back in the Stone Age. People are trading guns for spears. People are trading diamonds for apples. It's so wonderfully done. And I mean, they didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. It was just a few pages showing us what currency looks like now. Dollars don't matter anymore. Diamonds don't matter anymore. Gold bars don't matter anymore. Everything's predicated in usefulness, utility, and survivability. And things like fresh fruit are looked at as luxury. And that was just phenomenally done. We have Barbara doing the chronicling. Which, yes, it was an exposition dump, right? But it was so well done, and it gave us the flavor for the past 3 months here. We see how things broke down. We see, I mean, the map that they provided, the map was great and awful at the same time because Barbara's color coding was kind of sloppy. So it's like, we have three gangs that all have like blue marker, so it's like which one is which? Because I was gonna break it down that way, but I couldn't because the code, the little key code in the corner of the map, like it was all like there were like 10 things and there was like three colors, so it was very, very hard for me to parse who had what. But I love that it was there because you can picture Barbara in real time. I mean, we're there with her in the clock tower. We're watching this city be shredded into little fiefdoms run by crazy people and the police. It's wonderfully done. Wonderfully done. And I only hope that we get more of that as we move forward here. I don't remember if we do or not. I've only read these in the abridged form, so I don't know if we're gonna get like, oh well, this is what the Gotham map looks like this month. I hope we do, because I want to see the progress here. I want to track it. I think that could be fun. We get the bat sighting. No, spoiler alert, that ain't Batman. But it's someone who will loom large throughout this this little event that we're dealing with. But the most important scene for me, just the main takeaway here, was that magnificent Commissioner Gordon smashing the spotlight. You really can see the betrayal that he feels. And it was like almost one of them come to Jesus moments for the commissioner, where he's kind of looked into this twisted mirror. You know, he's seeing how he's viewed by outsiders. We saw the people in Ivytown a couple of episodes ago who laughed at him for wanting a job there. It's like, ah, he's the guy who lost Gotham. Here is where it's expanded upon and done beautifully, because this makes sense. You know, if you were the police commissioner anywhere and you had a bat-masked vigilante solving all your crimes or helping you with to solve all your crimes, you're probably going to be looked at a little side-eyed if you try to leave your home city. That makes perfect sense to me. You go to a different city, it's like, oh, you're the guy with the boogeyman. You're the guy with the inept police force who relies on a guy in his pajamas solving all your crimes. And I think that might have been the first time that Gordon actually realized how he looks to people outside. And that had to have been a major blow to his ego. So the fact that he now understands that he has relied on this boogeyman to the point where he is unhireable anywhere else, and now that boogeyman's abandoned him and the city, his outburst smashing that spotlight is just so damn powerful. And we're going to get some magnificent Batman and Gordon scenes as we work our way through this. There's one in, I want to say, Legends of the Dark Knight 125, which I can't wait for. It's very, very powerful. I think that might be the word for this issue. If I were to sum up my thoughts on No Man's Land number one in one word, it would be powerful, because this was. And it goes without saying, it should go without saying, this highly, highly recommended. And I thank myself for my insanity in doing it the way we're doing it, because had we started on January 1st of this year with this issue, it wouldn't have landed the same. Without Cataclysm, without Aftershock, without the Road 2, this wouldn't have had the power that it does. So I'm thankful that we spent 46 episodes getting here, because damn, we got here. And it means so much more. So if you haven't read this one, read it. Read it. Even if you can find that Gordon scene. Because that's some damn good comics. And I would hold that up against any scene. It was just that damn good. And with the context that we've got in the lead up, off the charts. Off the charts. And we're only at the start. So, looking forward to more. I hope you are as well. And I think this is where I'm going to stop talking about the issue itself. And we're going to go to that article from Wizard that we discussed a couple episodes ago. This is the first actual No Man's Land article in Wizard. It's not just a news blurb. It's not just a caption. It's not just a funny ha-ha. It's actually a full-blown article. And this is from Wizard number 89. January 1999 cover date. The article is called Risky Business, written by James A. Morisard. No Gotham City, a new Dark Knight, a revamped creative team. Is DC Comics risking Batman's future with the year-long No Man's Land storyline? It's not an Elseworlds, and it's not a dream. We got a lot of quotes here to go through. Denny O'Neil says, "We're still not sure we can pull this off. We know how it's going to end, but we don't know how we're going to get there. It's possible there's a big hole right in the middle of this that none of us are seeing. We could really fall on our faces." And like I said earlier, had I been part of this bad office and we put this issue out, there would be a whole lot of pride in me for the gutsy move here, but also so much fear that it's going to be so hard to walk back. Denny says that the storyline was inspired by boredom. Bored editors and bored writers, which they feared would translate to bored readers. O'Neill says, "It, No Man's Land, seemed like a big, dangerous story to try. It's a story that had never been told, as far as I know, certainly not in comics. That's always a reason to do something." Greg Rucka says, "No Man's Land is sort of a thematic throwback to Year One, in that Batman, and really all the people of the city, have to go back to basics. Batman has no cave, no utility belt, and no computer. He is really fighting the way he was trained to." Jordan Gorfinkel says, "This is a new status quo in the Batman books that will be an aspect of all the stories in the course of the year. No Man's Land is far from your typical multi-part crossover," Wizard says. "Instead, it's a backstory with numerous story arcs, each concerning a different Bat character. All the arcs run weekly through Batman, Detective Comics, Shadow, and even former out-of-continuity Legends of the Dark Knight, which will give O'Neill and Gorfinkel the convenience of a fourth monthly title." Paul Dini says, "The editors are really trying to do something new, to redefine Batman and his role in Gotham City, and to sort of reinvent the characters as they do periodically. They want to take what was and still continues to be wonderful and exciting about Batman and just redefine that to tell a great story." Now, besides writing the story arc featuring the Joker, I don't think he actually does this, but Dini will finally get to introduce Harley Quinn, the popular character from the animated television series, into the DC Universe. Now, Harley's not the only new character to grow out of No Man's Land. Fans will get to see the all-new Batgirl. Details of her origin and identity are being closely guarded by everyone in the Bat Camp. Don't be surprised if her identity isn't revealed at all during the entire crossover and months to follow. Now, when I mentioned Dini here, he, of course, will be doing the Harley Quinn one-shot, the prestige format deal. I don't think he writes the Joker story, though. I think that's someone else. The Joker story, I think, is called The Code, and it'll come a handful of episodes after Harley, and I don't think that was Dini. I think that's actually a writer I've never heard of before. I can't think of his name off the top of my head, though. Now, there's a portion of this article talking about acquiring new readers, which zaps me right into Usenet mode. They say here, "With any big change, there's always a gamble involved. No Man's Land could be the last straw with loyal and devoted fans who have grown weary of all the Bat crossovers in recent years and just want O'Neill and company to stop messing around with the Dark Knight." Gorfinkel says, "We are very aware of the vocal minority, and they are very vocal, who want us to leave well enough alone. These are the same people who wanted Hal Jordan to remain Green Lantern. I don't say this disparagingly because I'm one of them. I have a terrible fear of change, but I see that the comic book industry at large needs some shaking up, and the only character that can do that is Batman." He also says here that throughout No Man's Land, there's going to be a whole lot of non-No Man's Land Batman one-shots for readers who don't want to read the new normal but still need their Dark Knight fix. So, same as it ever was, I guess. I do really... Gorfinkel's statement here, it's one of those that I like reading, but at the same time, anytime a portion of the fandom is called a vocal minority, I don't know, my skin kind of crawls, because it's like, it could be every single fan, but they'll spin it to be like, it's just a vocal minority that aren't happy. Oh, everybody loves it, but this vocal, the people who like to complain like to do it the loudest, and I don't know, kind of feels like, not really owning the criticism. You know, it's more like pushing it to, there's this fringe who, they're loud, they're rowdy, they're, you know, they probably weren't going to buy it anyway, you know, that kind of thing. It feels very pseudo-defensive, I don't know. Some more quotes here, and this is one we've read before. Doug Mensch says, "I didn't think it was a good story and I didn't want to write it." Now, it's stated here that Mensch was originally slated to write the three-part Road to No Man's Land story that we read in Shadow of the Bat. Which doesn't sound quite right, does it? He was probably going to write the one in Batman. Though, in fairness, I doubt anybody at Wizard has read a single Batman book since Nightfall. Alan Grant and Chuck Dixon were booted from their main Batman books. But Dixon's not going away. He's sticking around on Nightwing and Robin, and Grant will be, well, he'll be on the fringe launching that Anarchy, quote-unquote, ongoing series. Now, there are some sections of this article here that are broken down into, like, little clutter boxes. We get a hero roll call, and we're going to start with Batman. We find out that he's ordered his sidekicks to leave Gotham, and he has disappeared himself for 3 months. Denny O'Neil says he will be sorely tested in No Man's Land, and he'll lose some of his arrogant cockiness. Batgirl. Batgirl's back, but who the F is she? That's basically it. Robin. Tim and Jack Drake up stakes and move to Keystone City, where Robin will team with Wally West for a bit. Nightwing. He's back in Bludhaven to try and manage the population boom of incoming Gotham expats. Oracle will serve as the No Man's Land chronicler, documenting the events of this new normal. She'll eventually be targeted by Black Mask. Well, not her so much as the Clock Tower will be. And Commissioner Gordon, he is a laughingstock to the rest of the world. Bob Gale says the following. Gordon figures that if he could bring some form of order to this insanity, it's going to prove that he is a good cop and a righteous man. Alfred. Where has he been since chauffeuring Master Bruce to Washington, D.C.? Well, the Wizard promises that we'll find out soon, and it's rumored to be quite the surprise. Huntress is the black sheep of the Bat family, and we'll have a run-in with the Scarecrow. Azrael sucks! Okay, it doesn't say that. He and Batman will squash their bad blood, and pretty much all of JPV's focus will be on taking down... Nicholas Scratch. Next up, our villain roll call, starting with the Joker. Now, he will hang over Gotham like a specter. He's hiding out, and his presence won't be felt for a very long time. We're gonna be seeing him next episode. Harley Quinn, Mr. J's beloved sidekick, joins the Bat Universe when the Joker makes his grand entrance. Writer Paul Dini is working on an imaginative way to bring her into Bat continuity without straying from the Batman at the animated series origin. Dini says, I don't want to get too far away from the idea that she's a therapist at Arkham Asylum who has a thing for the Joker. Catwoman. Catwoman moves to New York. Devin Grayson says she'll realize that she has underestimated her connection to Gotham and does end up going home to Gotham, which is a very clunky sentence. Worth noting, Devin Grayson will not be writing Catwoman by the time she ties in with No Man's Land. The Riddler hightails it out of Gotham. He'll tangle with Impulse before heading off to Hollywood. And we'll see that play out. Well, we probably won't, but it will play out in a Batman Chronicles short. Bane. He's going to break into No Man's Land to cause some chaos. You know, this new normal for Gotham is right up his alley. So, he's on the outside looking in, and he really wants to get in. Two-Face will play a significant role, possibly involving GCPD Detective Renee Montoya, but that role is being kept quiet. Mr. Freeze, I mean, we're really, you know, scraping the bottom of the barrel here. He claims the Gotham City power plant. Great. Penguin is controlling the black market and flow of goods into and out of the city. And the Scarecrow will run in with the Huntress. Now, here's an interesting part of this article. JLA-MIA. And it says here, you'd think an earthquake destroying a major city like Gotham and the United States government cutting it off from the rest of the civilized world would attract the Justice League of America's attention. Don't count on it. Grant Morrison says the following. This is one of those things that Batman will deal with on his own. The Justice League is just so powerful. In reality, they can come in and fix up any of these problems within a few hours. I think that's the reason behind it. It's not necessarily the way I would think about it, or the way I would do it, but that's how it'll be played. We'll just work around it and not make a big deal out of it. And, well, thanks to a little continuity fudging, Batman will be appearing regularly in JLA, even though he'll be busy trying to save Gotham City. Our man Gorfinkel says the following. We've been asked on many occasions how come the JLA, with all their fancy superheroes, don't just come to Gotham during Contagion or Cataclysm and just magically solve all the problems. Well, here's the interesting part. We'll be addressing that very early on in our No Man's Land World's Finest One-Shot Story. Does that ever happen? I don't think it does, or at least there ain't no book called that, or else I'm missing it. If there is, let me know. I don't think it happens, though. Now, they also promise here that while the JLA won't be coming to Gotham anytime soon, Young Justice will. So there's that. To close out our Wizard coverage here, just one notable thing. Robin wins the Best Comic Book Series of 1998 in their Best of the Best article, which is weird. I kind of came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting to see Robin be the best comic book series of the entire year, but here we are. And here I am, taking this episode home. Of course, this is a huge book. This is one of the bigger books we're going to talk about during this entire project, so I would love to hear your thoughts on it. Did you read it then? Is this your first time reading it? Have you read it and forgot about it? I mean, this was the first time I read this in almost 25 years. Jesus. A quarter century. What happened to my life? I haven't read this since that first trade collection came out all those years ago. So this was like a brand new thing to me. I didn't remember a lick of it. I certainly didn't remember the Commissioner Gordon scene, because that would have stuck with me. That was a hell of a scene. Then again, back then I read it without context. I didn't read any of the lead up. It was just like, boom, we're dropped in No Man's Land and off to the races. But yeah, if this is your first time reading this, if you haven't even read it and you're just listening to some idiot talk about it, I want to hear your thoughts. And of course, if you were there at the time, what were your thoughts when this hit the shelves? Did you drop all the Bat books? Did you become fanatically, you know, addicted to buying Bat books? I really, really want to know. I want to know how this change landed for you. Were you a part of the vocal minority who didn't like it? Or were you part of the crew who were making this a sellout in every comic shop in the country? Tell me. Of course, I could be reached all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, Facebook, Twitter, X, all those places. I'm around. I'm easy to find. And I'm looking forward to hearing from anybody who wants to rattle my cage. But with all that said, let's close this one down because my throat hurts. I want to thank you all so much for joining me on this journey and sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Knowing what you know just makes it harder to think straight, start.